السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. بسم الله والحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه وبارك وسلم. السلام عليكم. I'm just gonna open the YouTube also so I can see where people are at. Okay, mashallah. So we're going to get started. This is now for us kind of shifting gears and talking about Ramadan prep. And tonight, a lot of what we're going to be discussing in terms of Ramadan preparation is essentially what we're bringing of ourselves to this experience of Ramadan. And so to understand this in a framework of the self, you got to first know, like, what is it that makes you you in your entirety, and what this means in terms of its relationship to Ramadan. A lot of times what people say is, you know, at times platitudinally, like, you want to set intentions, but that's pretty much the base of a lot of what we do in our religion, is knowing why you're doing what you're doing before you even do it. And so a chunk of what we're going to talk about tonight is this concept of intention, what goes into our intentions, etc. What I'd like for you to do, just take a quick minute and turn to the persons next to you, so we can kind of familiarize ourselves with a new group of people. Like, what do you know about this concept of intentions within our tradition? Why is it something that's as emphasized as it is? And how do I start to align myself with intention in terms of my approach to Ramadan in particular, as well as any other kind of guiding things that might be in front of me right now, but it's a Ramadan prep class. So with this notion of intention, like, why is this such an emphasized thing, and how do I start to kind of bring presence to the formation of intention around Ramadan? Does the question make sense? Yeah. So you can turn to the person next to you, exchange some names, you know, how your day went, and let's start just with this so we can get discussing on things. Can we have everybody just move in a bit? Is that okay? So if you're kind of sitting towards my right, if you could shift over this way, that would be helpful. But go ahead. Feel free to just kind of talk it out for a little bit, and then we'll get started. Okay, so why is this thing so important? How do we even start to determine or align it for ourselves, this thing of intention. What are we discussing? What did you talk about? You just talked about what? You just talked about your day? That's all as far as you get? Oh my God. You know what's interesting is the one we just did on the 40 hadith had like 10 times as many guys in it and not as many like women. And now it's the reverse. I don't really know what's going on here. But interesting. Yeah. So what do we do with this thing of intentions? Like how do I start to align this for myself? What do I know about it? What did you talk about? And if you didn't talk about it, like just what comes up? Yeah. Yep.
Gives it its like context of positivity versus negativity, etc. And also like determines the magnitude of it. So we were talking about how you can take the smallest action that seems the most insignificant to anybody else. Like for example, maybe you decide that during Ramadan you want to be the person who smiles at everybody who you see. And that can be the tiniest thing. But if you power it with intention and you and especially direct that attention towards pleasing Allah, like the impact both for yourself, the reward, as well as the impact on people around you, can be like intensified by something you couldn't imagine.
Amazing. Other thoughts? Do you have your hand raised in the back? Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Why is it important or relevant to us right now as we're talking about Ramadan prep? Is it important? Okay, so then why? You can't be silent on the first one and then smile and nod at the second one. Why? Why is it important? You gotta think, like, Islam is a thinking person's religion. Do you know? It's not a religion that just says, you just got to believe it, even if it doesn't make sense. You just have to believe it, even if it's complicated and it takes me a long time to explain it to you, right? Why would God want a complex way of understanding him? Do you get what I mean? But the ability to utilize your mental faculties, your organ of cognition, to be able to then land in a place where the things that we know are important, if we have not built a relationship with them, then we're not going to utilize them. So none of you said anything when I said, why is it important? But all of you said yes when I said, is it important? Do you see? So why is it important as we prep for Ramadan to be able to situate for ourselves intentionality in that preparation? Yeah.
It basically says like a whole precursor to Ramadan itself. So like, you know, day one when you start fasting, right? Like usually people are very chaotic to wake up, like, you know, to wake up to suhoor. Some people are stressed out saying, oh my God, I gotta make this, I gotta make that, I gotta plan, you know, my day, I gotta plan how I'm gonna break my fast, like thought and whatnot. And you know, it's like I guess like having the right intention. And now you just like orient yourself to so that you're more organized, but it makes sure that, you know, you focus on what's important, right? You're centered, right, in terms of spiritual growth. It's not just, you know, I gotta wait for Maghrib so that I can eat X, Y, Z food, right? So that's why.
Great. Other thoughts? Yeah.
So we're gonna be dealing with a lot of physical limitations from one day to another, and I think it would be nice to just look back on our own intentions in case we are disappointed with a certain day.
Great. Anything else? Yeah.
Then, as Harris said, intentions inform the execution of our actions. So where our mind is at the outset, of the period helps us determine where we're going to go, but it also informs the evaluation of an action, right? As the sister said, where our heart is at when we're doing these actions informs how we're rewarded for it, and we want to make sure we're rewarded to the utmost extent in this blessed period.
Amazing. So if I asked you, where does intention live with you? Where does it exist? Because you exist and you have capacity. You're not everywhere, right? You are where you are right now. So if I said, show me your fingers, right? Fingers. These are your fingers. Where is intention exist within you? In your mind? Great. Anywhere else? In your heart. Amazing. So these are important things to understand, because fundamentally, everything in this religion goes back to the heart. It can choose to go elsewhere, but your Ramadan amplified is only achievable if you recognize all of you in your entirety that you're bringing to preparation for it. Does that make sense? Innamal a'malu binniyat. Indeed, actions are by their intentions. If you come to the 40 hadith class that we do, this is the first hadith that we looked at. You are not going to get a regurgitation of what we discussed in that class if you've come to it before or you've heard it someplace else before, but understand how this religion works. You don't learn something here and then learn something here and then they exist separate from each other. But you learn this thing here so that you can apply what you've learned to what it is that you're learning over here. Does that make sense? So how does, like, Surah Ikhlas, chapter of the Quran that a lot of us know, right? قُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ أَحَدٌ, say that He is God, the only one, right? How does that apply to Ramadan? How does, like, Fatiha apply? You don't have to know, like, the whole book to be able to take and extrapolate and apply to things. So this hadith, this prophetic narration, the hadith of intentions, is pretty much the first hadith that's in every book of hadith that you read. The hadith on intentions. Because you want to know why you're going to do what you're going to do before you do it. It's not that you can't do without knowing, because you can categorize actions into conscious and unconscious modes of exertion. And there's good in both, and there's things that are problematic in both, right? Like the blessing of being able to do without consciousness. In Arabic, this is called a fa'il. You're doing an act, but there's no presence to it. You don't have to think about every time you blink your eyes. What if you had to do that? What if you had to think about every time you took a breath? Now I'm going to blink, now I'm going to breathe, now I'm going to blink, now I'm going to breathe. What would your life be? I've sat with people in hospitals who they cannot breathe on their own. May Allah make it easy for them. It's not an easy thing. There's individuals who have all kinds of challenges that what we can do with unconscious just existence, they have to exert conscious frames. When you add in now the element now of intention, intention can be broken down into what is actual and what is perceived. Because you could think that you're doing it for the right reason. I'm telling you that you should pray 5 times a day. Not a bad thing to say to somebody. But what if I'm telling you to make you feel like garbage? Right? The manifestation of the act is still rooted in the same, but the intentionality behind it is different. And I wrestle with it because the acceptance of the act in Islam as a religion brings together two pieces, intention as well as a sound act. Both of them have to be good, not in the prism of moral relativism, but in the prism of what does God say goodness is. And sometimes what is apparent of an act can seem like it does not have goodness to it, but the intention is what makes it whole. So what if you saw me late at night and I was standing, walking out of a club in Manhattan, right? Just get that mental picture in your head. Call it in the club. It's the worst thing in the world you could think of. You don't know what's going on, but it's like, man, I just prayed Juma behind that guy and he's coming out. Nobody's thinking, what am I doing out at 2 o'clock in the morning, driving past the club late at night, right? But what if I was there because I know there's a young woman who I was told she blacks out when she drinks and people then become predatorial. Do you get what I mean? So the understanding of it still has consequence at the end of the day. I've willfully chosen to be in a place that I have accountability of perception. It might not apply the same to everybody, but I have like a figure as a community servant, so certain things come in different ways. You all are nice people, and you're not like super judgy of me, so most of you probably wouldn't be like, man, he must have been up in there like de-stressing. This is how he preps for Juma on a Thursday night. No. But fundamentally, the intent is more kind of what the objective is in a case by case. But the norm is both have to go hand in hand. You can have terrible intention to acts that also are terrible, right? And the intention is the gift that keeps you in check. How can I fundamentally, in the name of God, like hit my child? Really think about it. May Allah protect us from this. How can you, in the name of God, like be racist? How can you, in the name of God, be hateful, xenophobic? How can you fundamentally, in the name of God, gossip, lie, backbite, cheat? Like, what kind of God do you believe in at that point in time? Innama al-amalu bin-niyat creates for me intention that also sets for me a standard. My intent is to wake up for suhoor every day in Ramadan, right? You should try your best to wake up for the pre-fajr meal because the Prophet says, peace be upon him, that there's blessing in it, even if just taking a sip of water. The intent in it, and blessing, barakah, if we give it a definition that I'm going to say pretty much every time we meet, barakah is the ability to do more with less. So you want it, you got to do the things that bring it into play. Your intent becomes a metric of assessment. If you really want to pray for Fajr, tell me how you sleep at night and stay awake at night indicates that your intention is real. Does it make sense? You want to get up before the sun rises to drink even a sip of water. Your intention has to be now what is the metric of being like, this is what I'm trying to achieve. How is all this stuff leading into it going to make that possible? On Friday night, was here. We had a healing circle for Sudan. May Allah make things easy for the people of Sudan, right? Supposed to end at 9. We ended at 11. It was a beautiful space. Wish we could have stayed even later. I got to the bus stop at Astor Place, and I'm waiting for the bus. And I'm not going to say, like, there was a problem. Most of the bus drivers in New York, they're really nice. Sometimes they even stop in the rain for me because we go on the same bus routes, right? We know each other. I did not know this person. I'm in my thobe, in my turban. I'm looking at the bus schedule. It's supposed to be moving. The bus is not moving. The bus driver's looking at me. I'm looking at her. Nothing's happening, right? And then all of a sudden, this guy taps me on my shoulder. And it's a kid who graduated from here years ago. And he's with two other brown guys. Now four of us, close to midnight, are standing. This bus driver looks petrified out of her mind, right? So the guy said to me, hey, I'm going to go to Union Square to pick up some chicken and rice. He said, I've called it in already. And I said, who calls in chicken and rice to a street car? He was like, no, I called the guy. I know him. He's going to have it ready for me. And so I walked with him to Union Square. This is all true. And I walked to Union Square with him. And then I walked to my apartment from there. And I got into bed like around 1 o'clock in the morning. I woke up at Fajr the next day. And my family and I, we had to go somewhere. And we like got back home, and then the next day I had to wake up again to do some stuff. And then at like 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, I just passed out and I just slept because I needed to sleep. And I woke up because I need to pray. And then I went to bed like at a reasonable hour. But I had a few days that were off of my routine. And so this morning, after Fajr, I was up helping get my kids ready. And then I just fell asleep again for a couple of hours. And my wife, who's amazing, make dua for her, she said, I'll take the kids to school because I normally take them. And my daughter, who does now walks sometimes to school by herself, but she likes when we walk her, she said, Baba, you rest. I'm going to just walk to school. So I was like, amazing. I was like just knocked out on my couch, right? I need to do that with mindfulness and strategy so that I am able to fulfill intention throughout the rest of the course of the week. Do you get what I mean? And I know, based off of my behavior, that it's not going to allow for me to actualize what's necessary to yield the objective, right? Imam Ghazali, rahimahullah, who's like a great spiritual kind of teacher, knowledgeable scholar across our religious tradition. He was at like the pinnacle of what you could be in terms of notoriety, scholarship, you know, books that he'd written, etc., prestigious positions. And then he just left all of it to go to places where nobody knew who he was. There's stories where people would find him like sweeping in like masjids, right? Really remarkable individual, but deeply aware of a lot of things, and you should read his books and his text. A lot of them are translated into English. He said that niyya, intention, is the motivation of the self, its aim, and inclination to obtain the manifestation of its goal, either presently or in the future. It sets for me a metric that, similar to like if you're driving your car and you missed a turn, you become aware of the fact that you missed the turn, and then you go back and you say, I gotta figure out how to get back to my destination. Doesn't mean you're a bad human being, but it's setting for you now metrics of assessment. Am I getting to where I wanted to be? The intention is setting that for me. Does that make sense? Right? Ibn Taymiyyah, rahimahullah, who ideologically is on like another end of a spectrum from Imam Ghazali, but both really well-known, prolific scholars, he says the place of niyyah is the heart or the conscience, these organs of cognition, and not on the tongue. So my intention becomes a means through which I can measure, like what I'm doing, does it own up to what it is that I'm saying? And that can be in the present or the future, right? I want to have this job that's going to make me a lot of money so I can give to people who don't have money. So a lot of people say, you know what, Khalid, I'm going to go and I'm going to work in corporate America. I'm going to do this. I'm like, great, man. Allah give you tawfiq. And I'm going to make millions of dollars and I'm going to go give it to people. And then they'll sit with me like 6-7 years later and we're having a conversation and they're like, how come I'm not giving money to people? I'm like, I don't know. I'm happy to figure that out with you. What are the obstacles that get in the way? But the actualization of the intention, they now have a means to say, this is why I said I was going to do what I did. This is why I prayed to God saying, give me this thing. Nobody prays to God saying, can you give me this spouse so I treat them like garbage 10 years from now, right? Nobody prays to God saying, I really want to have a kid so that I can oppress my child, right? What gets in the way? There becomes an absence of intentionality and a revisiting of intention. You wanted it and you asked for it. And then when it was given to you, did you do with it what it was that you said you would actually want it to do? When Ibn Taymiyyah says the place of intention is in the conscience or in the heart and not on the tongue, it doesn't mean you don't express it, right? But in order for us to get out of what we can from Ramadan, if this thing exists in the heart, that's what all of you said in unison. And it's interesting what all of you say in unison, right? Why is intention important? Nobody says nothing. Is it important? Yeah. Everybody says yes. Great. What is this thing of intention? Where does it exist? You know, everybody says the heart. Amazing. You have inside of you this thing that is your spiritual heart. Inside of you also, in an Islamic framework of the self, you have the intellect, the aqal, you have the nafs, the lower self, you have the ruh, the soul, the spirit, you have irada, sheer will and determination, and so much more. Niyya, intention, is in your heart. It makes sense that people forget their intention as they get older, because so much of the world is telling you to feed the physical and not to be focused on the heart. If I told you, show me in your calendars in the last day, week, month, not what's forthcoming, but what's already transpired in the last week, the last month, show me what you did with the time you spent that your heart is important to you. What could you point at that's deliberate, not organic? It was really nice. Like somebody I haven't talked to in a while, they called me and they spoke to me and I just felt great after meeting with them. Great, that's a gift from God. You didn't plan it. What are you planning for the wellness of your heart? Why is this relevant to what we're talking about here? If intention is in your heart, then it gets blurred if there's a lot of other stuff in the heart too. Right? And what you're bringing of yourself to Ramadan is yourself in its entirety. So I want you to take a few minutes, open up a notebook, write at the top. If you don't have a notebook, take out a phone and actually do it, right? If you don't do it, I'm going to push back on you as your brother who loves you and says, you have to care about yourself enough to do it. If you don't yield to process, you're not going to get out of it. Because inside of your mind, if you just think kind of in a vacuum, it's going to be all this other mess. The function of writing is going to help you to stay a little bit more attentive. So what I'd like you to do, since everybody said intention is important, and everybody said the heart is where intention lives, your words, not mine, what's in your heart right now? If you were to identify the things that are given abode inside of this important piece of you, what exists in there? What lives in there? Emotions, feelings, memories, things that are helpful, things that are painful. The spiritual heart has capacity, and you can write as I'm talking. It's not infinite in what it can hold. So if you have a cup that is filled to its brim, you cannot put more into it until it is emptied. If we want to meet Ramadan in a place that we reach our best through it, but we are also as best as we can be, it doesn't mean we have to heal from everything, but we have to first even acknowledge what's in this thing to begin with. And if I don't admit what's there, it doesn't mean that it's not there. So I want you to take a good, like, few minutes, 5 minutes, not 2 minutes, right at the top. What is being housed in my heart? What are the things that I actually love? Right? What is my heart attached to? Healthy, unhealthy? What is it holding on to? What's like sitting in it? Do you know? But just take a few minutes and be with yourself. If I was to take an inward look, my heart is in front of me. What would I find within it? Okay. So if you take 2 minutes and now just turn to the person next to you, what is that process like for you? You don't have to say what you actually wrote unless you feel like you're inclined towards, but that's just for you and your eyes and God. But just the actual process of reflecting, like, what am I holding in myself? What am I carrying in myself? Do you know what I mean? If you can talk to the person next to you, what was it like to engage in that as a process? And then we'll come back and discuss. But go ahead. If you don't know the name of the person next to you, just share names, and we'll come back.
No, that one was alright.
Okay, so what was it like, the process of just kind of that inward reflection, you know, as you are trying to determine this is what you're bringing to Ramadan. So how does that process go for you? What was that like for people experientially? What did you talk about? Yeah.
I said that it was very instinctful. Like, basically, I was like, I didn't really think about a lot of the things, like how I was wording it. It was just like, you know, I just kept on going and going. And then when I'm looking at some of the things I'm writing, like, some of the things were actually very surprising. I was like, wow, like, you know, this is something that actually, like, I hold in my heart. Like, that actually has, like, you know, significant space, you know. And I don't think about these things on an everyday basis. So it was definitely something where I'm like, you know, oh, maybe I should, you know, think about this more or resolve this issue or whatever it may be.
So. Great. Anyone else? Even if it's tough, it was easy, like, yeah.
I think most of the group, they basically said how, like, at first you not really want to admit it, or you feel like, oh, I'm not have the time for this, you know. But then, like, you know, you have to, like, sort of, like it was hard accepting the truth, because, like, you're not gonna really want to put it on paper. You just want to, you know, like, clean it up and, like, no. Like, the more and more you, like, the more and more you have to realize this is true. Like, this is, like, what's actually in my heart, and how we never really have the time to put aside that. Instead, we just, you know, we don't really reflect on that as much as we should.
Yeah. If you have an obstacle and you pretend like it's not there, it doesn't mean that it's not there still, right? Like if I want to get over there and there's a literal barrier in front of me, I have to still figure out how to get past the barrier. And if I'm pretending like the barrier is not there, and I'm then getting frustrated that I'm not getting to my destination, the feeling of stuckness is not necessarily because I don't know where I want to be, but I'm not actually willing to admit what's getting in the way. You understand? And so if you want to get ready for Ramadan, you got to know like what's going on inside, right? Ibn Taymiyyah, when he says this, rahimullah, the place of niyyah is not on the tongue, but it's in the conscious and in the heart. What else is in your heart then? You have a love of validation for people, the insecurities, like things that are positive also, right? And if your frame is only about all the garbage that's in there, that's also telling you something about how you see yourself and how you make sense of the word. You know, like if I open my heart, I got a lot of love for my kids, for my wife. I got a lot of love for like all of you. You know what I mean? Like there's so much that goes into this that also has positives. But if I'm overwhelmed by denying the negative and I don't see it as a necessary part to be able to enhance the positive, then I'm also taking away from the positive as best as I can. Do you know what I mean? What do we have here?
We got some food from
Tahini. Oh, great. If anybody wants food, there's now food here. Yeah, so feel free to grab some. So do you get what I'm saying, right? When Allah chooses who's going to be the last prophet to mankind, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiallahu anhu, who we talked about in the 40 hadith class, he's an early companion of the prophet. He's one of the black companions. There's narrations that speak about his hair being in braids. He's the first one to recite Quran publicly. He is of a small physical stature. Sometimes the companions would like laugh at him at how skinny his legs were. There's a hadith where like the wind blows and you can see his legs and they're kind of making a joke. And the prophet says those legs are going to weigh heavier on the scales on the day of judgment than the mountain of Uhud, right? Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is no joke. And he narrates a hadith that says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ نَظَرَ فِي قُلُوبِ الْعِبَادِ فَوَجَدَ خَيْرَ قُلُوبِ الْعِبَادِ قَلْبَ مُحَمَّدٍ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمَ فَاسْتَفَاهُ لِنَفْسِي. That indeed Allah looks into the hearts of His righteous servants, and He finds that the best of hearts is the heart of Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. And so He chooses him to be His last prophet. He endows him with this responsibility. When God is choosing His messenger, the place that He starts with is the heart. When God looks at us, the tradition doesn't say that God looks at our outwards. It actually says the opposite. God doesn't look at your bodies and your forms, but He looks at your hearts and your deeds. So you want to start where Allah starts. There's a companion by the name of Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As. So there's four Abdullahs who are companions of the Prophet. They are younger companions. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is not included in them because he became Muslim in the early part of Islam in Mecca. So these other four, right? Abdullah ibn Umar, Abdullah ibn Abbas, Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As, and one more who I don't remember the three that I said, but there's four of them, right? And so Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As, he's the son of a man by the name of Amr ibn al-As, who was at one point one of the staunchest enemies of Islam. And he then converts. His son Abdullah is a Muslim. And Abdullah radiallahu anhu, he's with the Prophet on one occasion when a companion by the name of Anas is narrating this experience. And the Prophet says, do you want to see a man of paradise? And they say, yes. And this man comes, his beard is disheveled. The narration says he's just made like a fresh wudu. He's just washed up for prayer. And then he came to pray, and they say he was carrying both of his shoes in his left hand. They're giving a depiction because nobody knows who this man is. He's not like a senior companion of the Prophet. There's nothing distinct about him. So they're mentioning distinct qualities as if these are the things that make him distinct. The second day, the same thing happens, and the third day, the same thing happens. When the Prophet gets up to leave, Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As, he follows the man, and he tells him, "My father and I are having an argument. Can I stay in your house?" And the guy says, "Yeah, go for it." He doesn't say, "What are you fighting about? Like, what's going on over there?" He just says, "You can stay in my home." Abdullah radiallahu anh, he stays in the house for 3 days. He says, "I see him, he prays Isha, but he's not praying anything extra. He gets up for Fajr, but he's not getting up at night. Like, there's not like a bunch of things he's doing in the secret parts of the night. The guy's just doing like his obligations. Do you know?" So Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As, after 3 nights passed, and he didn't find anything that was so unique in what was going on in this man's nights, he says to him that, "I am not in an argument with my father, and I don't have any problems with my dad. I'm here because I heard the Prophet say 3 times on 3 days that you are a man of paradise." Right? Basically saying, like, what's going on? Because you're not doing anything like that's so unique. You're just praying Isha and you're praying Fajr. You know, like, what's happening, right? And the man says to him, and he says, "Why did the Prophet convey this about you?" And the man says, and I just want to read like his words verbatim. He says, "It is not but as you see, except that I find no malice within myself towards others. Nor do I envy anyone for the good that Allah has given them." And Abdullah radiallahu anh, he says, "This is what was conveyed. This is what was conveyed about you, for we have been unable to do so." Does it make sense? I have no malice towards these Muslims. I have no envy towards people. He just cleans his heart out regularly. He's showing up to pray. Nobody knows his name. Why does he need to be known? He's designated by the Messenger of God as a man of paradise. Now you want to think consequently why. If you got goodness in here, then it's going to reflect on the goodness you put into the world. You can only give what it is that you possess in the first place. Right? So if I have pain, I'm going to give pain. If I have anger, I'm going to give anger. If I have all kinds of stuff in me, that's what I'm going to give to people. It doesn't mean that I'm the one that put it inside of me, but if it's there, I still am able to address it and deal with it. So here, this man is in a place where, alhamdulillah, that he is just not carrying that baggage inside of him. There's no heaviness here, right? And these are people who are real humans. The beauty of Islam is that it gives us very human insight and interactions on things. Do you know? When we went to Mecca and Medina some weeks ago, and we were standing at Uhud, this is a place where a battle takes at the mountain of Uhud that the Muslims lose. Prior to it, they have a battle at a place called Badr that the Muslims win against all odds. There's like 300 Muslims and 4 digits of Quraysh. They think they're going to be annihilated. The Prophet is literally making dua, praying to God, that like everybody who's going to make this religion continue is here. If we lose, this religion stops right at this place. You know? They win Badr. It's the second year after Hijra. The third year after Hijra is the Battle of Uhud. They lose. And they lose badly. A lot of the senior companions of the Prophet get killed at Uhud. There's a lot of just difficulty in the aftermath of this. In the 8th year after Hijra is when they come and Mecca is now taken back by the Muslims. And they walk in, all of them, and the Meccans are in a place where they have a lot of trepidation. Because in this society, you do wrong by someone, they have right to do wrong by you. And there's a man from the Muslims who says in the hadith La Quraysh Ba'd al-Yawm. There's going to be no Quraysh after today. He's carrying this since Uhud. 5 years he's holding on to it. And the Prophet says, everybody's forgiven today. Do you get what I mean? If you're carrying clutter inside of you, it doesn't go away on the first day of Ramadan. You're still bringing it to Ramadan. And if intention exists in the heart and in the conscience, and you are in a place where you are not willing to take a minute, how long did you sit for? 3 minutes. I'm looking at the clock. 3 minutes. What's in my heart? I don't want to admit it, but it's there. The things that are healthy, the things that are unhealthy, it's all there. You don't have to address it alone, but if you don't address it, it doesn't mean that it's not present. Does that make sense? And the tears you cry in Ramadan, you want them to be like tears of spiritual joy and relief. You don't want them to just be tears of heaviness and like pain. There's a difference between crying and wailing, you know? And once it opens, it just opens and it lets itself out. But I can learn about myself through myself. Ramadan has never been about empty stomachs. It's been about full hearts. The idea of treating your celestial self, your inner self. The world outside of you could care less about the state of your heart. That's why it teaches you to look at yourself and not for yourself. I walked into our Sunday school a week ago and I was wearing like a black, you know, shalwar and peacoat jacket, and I had a black umbrella in my hand. Some of the parents said, like, you look so nice. And why? And, you know, I was just being honest with them. I was supposed to do a workshop for kids on prayer that day. So I wanted to be like, oh, it's because of the kids. But realistically, the night before, I was wearing the same clothes. And I just left them on the side of my bed. And I put them on the next morning. And then I came to the halakha on Monday last week. And I wore the same outfit again. My kid said to me, Baba, Mama says we're not supposed to wear the same clothes every day. And I say, look, man, I don't want the anxiety of trying to figure out a new outfit every day. I'm not saying you shouldn't change your clothes every day, because I'm scared of your mother, and I don't want her to get upset with me. But I don't get dressed for the reasons that other people sometimes get dressed. That doesn't mean I was always like that. But nobody's coming up to me and saying, other than you, Kareem and Medina, like, why are you wearing the same clothes 3 days in a row? You know? It doesn't have to just be about clothes, but your core belief structure, positive and negative, through your socialization. Am I worthy of love? Am I not worthy of love? Am I worthy of success? Am I not worthy of success? Am I beautiful? Am I not beautiful? The Quran says you're beautiful. لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي أَحْسَنِ تَقْوِيمٍ. We created humanity in the most beautiful of forms. What changed that you stopped seeing yourself the way God sees you? And all of it goes to the heart. Ramadan can be a mechanism through which we can reclaim some of this, but intentionality has to be rooted beyond just an expression of the tongue. I want to wake up for suhoor. We'll see embedded in suhoor a transformational aspect of just dealing with heaviness in the heart. Awareness, consciousness, wakefulness. But you got to start from this place. Some of the things that we can do now as you're getting ready, that you have to choose to actually do what I'm saying. Don't like not do it. Or one of those things where we come back next week and I'm like, is this a good thing? And all of you are like, yeah, it's great. Right? And I said, who did it? And then there's silence. You want to be different from most people. You want to take what you know and act on what you know and keep them close together. Most people, they don't do what it is that they know that's going to be good for them, even when it's hard, but also especially when it's easy. In a room as diverse as this, I can't tell you individually how to deal with the clutter that's inside of you in this setting, we could sit and talk one-on-one if you want, but some generic things that we can engage in as we're trying to create some space inside or vision modification of what's going on inside of our heart. One of the things that the Prophet teaches us, peace be upon him, is putting good in your heart in a way that practices like appreciation and gratitude. And you can't see this as something that is, again, just at a surface level. You have to actually engage in it. So, for example, at the end of every prayer, we're taught to say Subhanallah, glorifying God, Alhamdulillah, praising and thanking God, Allahu Akbar, like proclaiming God's greatness. There's a narration that speaks about this as the Tasbih of Fatima, a litany of the Prophet's daughter, Fatima, that she lives in a state of poverty. Her husband Ali is not a rich man. And they come to the Prophet asking for help and assistance, and he gives her this litany, this remembrance, say these things 33, 33, 34 times, right? There's other narrations that just say, like say it 10 times each for a total of 30 times. You do it 5 times a day, it's 150 times, and it'll be written as if you did it 10 times over, 1,500 times. And then in that hadith, the Prophet says, people aren't going to do it. And the companions say, why would they not do it? And the Prophet says, because their hearts are going to be distracted by something else. They're going to be pulled towards something else. You can't make these things after the prayer if you don't pray in the first place. And then when you sit down to pray, you want to think, like, for those who pray their prayers, and that should be all of you, not because it's burdensome, but because it's an oasis. You shift paradigms, and it all goes back to the heart again, right? Just think about the postures of prayer and all the nonsense that's filtering in your head when you're standing and bowing in your prayer. And then think about the silence that comes when you're in prostration. Just pay attention to it in the course of your prayer. The mess that's floating in your head in every other motion likely is not as present, if at all, when your head is on the ground. Why is that? And just think about it. This aspect of gratitude, it is something that you can do in a lot of different ways. But relevant to these words, glorifying God, praising and thanking God, proclaiming God's greatness, you attach meaning to it. Why am I glorifying God? What am I praising and thanking God for? I bring some intentionality to it. There's deliberate modes of contentment. When you can be satisfied with what you have, you're bold enough to ask the question, just like you wrote at the top of your notebook, like, what's in my heart? You write at the top of your notebook, how much is enough? The stuff doesn't do it for you. You can be as rich and wealthy as the most wealthiest person in the world. Doesn't your heart still hurt when you're sad? Does all the stuff make you feel as good as the person you love makes you feel? It's not a joke that Fatima and Ali, radiallahu anhumah, may God be pleased with both of them, they don't have a lot of stuff. And then they're given this in exchange, a mechanism to recenter the inner self. I don't know why you don't do it, but if you don't know why, because you've never sat with intention before, now is the time to think, what's in my heart? What's distracting me when I sit on the prayer mat that I can't even sit for 20 seconds and say Subhanallah, Alhamdulillah, Allahu Akbar 10 times each, let alone 33 times? It's a spiritual exercise that's going to have impact on my heart. The gratitude that goes into this, you can understand what the Quran tells us as a default state. It talks about humanity a lot and characteristics that we have. So there's a chapter in the last part of the Quran. It's called Surat Al-Adiyat. It gives these depictions of these really beautiful horses as they're moving in directions in unison. And there's a verse that says, إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لِرَبِّهِ لَكَنُودِ, that indeed humanity towards their Lord is ungrateful. There's just no appreciation or gratitude there. The recognition of a gift or a blessing, right? Like, you love this space that you're sitting in right now. What do you do to keep it clean? What do you do to take care of it and provide for it? What are you doing to sustain it if you love it, so that a generation after you've left from this world, people still have it? How do you take your spiritual gifts and express, not just from the tongue, but with actions, the utilization of them from the gift giver's point of view, not your own? The idea of recognizing a ne'mah, a blessing, is not so just the blessing is recognized, but as a mechanism to recognize the giver of the gift, the giver of the blessing. And a good number of people in the world think that just because they have something, it means they deserve it. What did you do? What did you do so that you have all the stuff that you have? I worked hard for it. There's people I could show you on the street when I walk here. They are in the cold, in the rain, in the snow, pushing shopping carts filled with plastic bottles and cans to recycle them. They work harder than all of us. Why do they have what they have and you have what you have? It's not a product of how hard you work. You're just telling yourself, I somehow did something to deserve it. What did you do? And when you can recognize it's not a matter of deserving it, then you can recognize what it is. It's a gift. When somebody gives you a gift, you use it in the ways that the gift giver intended for you to use it, not the way that you want to use it. My parents don't give me a laptop when I'm a child so that I can do things that I would never want them to know I'm doing with it. Allah didn't give me the gift of speech so that when my child grows old, he is paralyzed because of all the adult words that I put into his child heart. Do you get what I mean? The power of gratitude now is that when you can recognize how much is enough, you can ask, what is enough? You start to see what's there as opposed to what's not there. Not just outwardly, but inwardly. I can see your beauty, but I'm not afraid to recognize my own. I don't perceive myself through shortcomings, lackings, inefficiencies, inadequacies. I don't see why I'm not good enough. I can see my areas of improvement, but I can also recognize where I have capacity to do right because there's goodness in me. So you want to sit every so often as a mechanism to dispel like the blanket of negativity that says everything sucks. Everything does not suck. It's a false statement when you say it. I've been to parts of the world where I've sat with people pulling not just their remainings of their belongings, but searching for their loved ones under the rubble of home. And they're still saying, Alhamdulillah. It's not an exaggeration. How is that fundamentally possible? I make dua. I want to have a heart like that. But one thing throws me off of my course. I didn't get that job. I didn't get that spouse. I didn't get that car. I didn't get that thing. And all of a sudden, it's the worst thing. God must hate me. So you sit every so often. There's two methods that you can engage this with in preparation for illuminating the heart. Because the Prophet says, he who is not thankful of people is not thankful of the divine. Start saying phrases like thank you more. Express gratitude for people that you know and you don't know, right? I say it with love. I sit here with kids who come from other colleges and they say to me, do the kids who go to this school know what they have as Muslims? Because in my school, it is not anything like this. And I'm like, no, I love my community, but a lot of the kids, they take it for granted. They don't know actually what they've been gifted and given. And then when they graduate and they come back and they're like, man, I didn't know what I had. I wished I had used it a little bit differently. was always still here for you to come back to. But you express appreciation by caring for the gift, by looking over it, not just using it and then leaving it. Does it make sense? So one of the things that we do quite often is we don't express thanks to the people who we have in our lives. A mode of which you can do this is by saying thank you to people. I'm going to read you a letter that I wrote to my mother. I used to every day write an op-ed for the Huffington Post in Ramadan. I don't know how old any of you are to remember this. Did anybody actually read these things when I used to write them? You did not read them, man. What are you talking about? I wrote these things in 2011. How old were you in 2011? 3 years old? Not so old. Yeah. So 2011, he was 4 years old in 2011? So I got married in 2011, right? Is that true? I think so. Let's go with it. Yeah. So I'm writing these things, and I'm writing it at a time where I'm also still, like, single in New York. I grew up in a Muslim family. Some of you have, some of you haven't. Some of you are still trying to decide Islam is right for you. If you grow up in a Muslim family that practices and observes Ramadan, there's a good chance as a kid, somebody else is waking up before you to get your meal ready for the day before Fajr. My mom was up before any of the rest of us, ate after all of us ate, and went to sleep much later than everyone else did. As a single man, I appreciated this amazingly, in that I now realized how difficult it is to do these things for yourself. So I would wake up and just hurl whatever I could in my mouth. Didn't make any sense. And so I would write these op-eds at like 2 a.m. I'd come home from iftar and tarawih here, or night prayers, and I had to write one of these every day. I wrote them like seriously. And so one I wrote, it was called Love for My Mother. And at the end of it, I wrote a thank you letter to my mom. And I'm going to read this to you, and I want you to think about someone who you've never thanked properly in your life. And then I'm going to ask you to write a letter to them also. You don't have to share it with them. That's step number 2. They could be somebody who's passed away, and then it's different. But if they're still alive, you potentially can share with them. So 2 a.m, I'm sitting on my couch, and I wrote this letter to my mom. I called my mother Ummi, like that's what growing up in our house, we called our mother. So I said, thank you, Ummi, for all your continued support, affection, and love. Thank you for every kiss and every hug. Thank you for staying up with me late at night when I was sick, for making me up early to drive me to my football games, and calling me even today to make sure I'm getting enough sleep. Thank you for making me spinach every time I come home to visit. No one makes it as good as you do. Thank you for coming to watch every one of my games when I was younger and for encouraging me in everything I do in my life today. Thank you for being someone who listens and doesn't make me do things just because you did them a certain way. Thank you for not forcing me to be a doctor or a lawyer or anything else that most Desi parents force their children to become. Thank you for treating Priya like she is your own daughter and welcoming her into our family with open arms and embraces. Thank you for your patience, your understanding, and your commitment. Thank you for overlooking my mistakes and for teaching me so much. I would not be anything today if not for you. Thank you for being such an inspiration and great example to me of how a person should be. I pray that every child in this world is blessed with having a mother such as you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You're the most amazing person that I know, and I love you. And I published this, and I was in tears. Even now, I'm trying to keep tears back. I wrote this in 2011. The next morning, I got emails and text messages from people all over the world. Religious scholars, people who are not Muslim, we read this thing, it made us think of our moms or other people. My sister called me that afternoon, and she said, I'm at home. Mom read what you wrote. She's sitting here crying. Good job. Some years later, I'm sitting in my office over here. This building was built in 2012. You should know your history. So in 2011, this didn't exist. We were in the church basement on 6th Avenue at that time. 2012 is when this building went up. So sometime after that, I'm sitting with someone in my office. I'm talking to them about practicing gratitude, these thank you letters. I shared this thing. And then I just stopped talking. And this poor woman who I'm talking to, she didn't know what to do. Because I'm just silent now. And she's like, are you okay? I said, you know what's crazy? I wrote this thing. And it clearly moved me when I wrote it. And I know hundreds of thousands of people read it the next day. And a lot of people told me how it also moved them. And I even know that my mother read it and it moved her. The crazy thing is, I still haven't gone face to face and said thank you to my mother. Why is that? What makes that so hard? And when you can overcome that gap, it's going to definitely be something that illuminates the heart. Somebody vacuums this floor that we pray on. Do you ever make dua for that person? Do you ever pray for them? When you walk into the bathrooms and you make wudu and you spill water all over the place, who's cleaning it up? Did you ever thank God for that person being in your life? The person who writes your name on the cup of coffee that you order to your specificity, they have a name too. The persons who drive your Ubers, the persons who drive the buses. Appreciation and gratitude is a really remarkable thing. And this is where the second step in the letter writing is imperative. Because when you share it with someone, it'll validate for them. Because a lot of people go throughout their life and nobody thanks them for anything. I have the blessing of serving a community that I know cares about me and checks in on me. And reaches out and says, are you okay? Do you need anything? You know all these people that you see all over your social media? The ones that are standing up for Palestine, the ones that are speaking out. What do you think their lives are like when the cameras turn off? When all of these people who don't want them to say what they're saying also hear what they're saying? How do you show gratitude and appreciation towards them? How do you thank them? And when you can recognize it just as added blessing, that person will feel validated when you express appreciation, but your heart is going to soften because you know there's somebody who has done for you in your life that brings you to this place. None of you are where you are by your own volition. If you believe that, there's fundamentally a challenge in your sense of self. It might not be the people you wanted it to be. And I'm sorry, if family didn't do right by you, friends didn't do right by you, that's not an easy thing. But there can't be anyone in your life that you could say thank you to. You could apply it to other things. Why is it so hard to say I'm sorry? It's one of the best ways to say I love you to someone. I'm sorry. But for what we're talking about tonight, one of the things you want to do between this week and next week, figure out who that person is. Write them a thank you letter. A teacher who did something for you, a friend who did something for you. You don't have to share it with them, but step number two. And what it'll build is attentive focus, as what was being said before when I said, what's in your heart, and you wrote down with the paper, most of you didn't have, like, fleeting thoughts pulling you in different direction, because the exercise allows for you to have the equivalent of what's a spotter in a physical exercise. If your mental strength needs to be built, the paper and the notebook is going to equip you to have more focus than if you were just doing it without anything there to kind of keep your mind in a place where it's anchored. Do you know what I mean? And when you start writing this, you're not going to want to stop. It's like Sayyid ibn Musayyib, rahimahullah, who is a well-known scholar of our religion. He says that, I know when my prayer is just like being accepted, because the tears, they're falling, the goosebumps are riddling my arms, but I don't want to stop praying. I just want to keep praying and keep praying and keep praying. So you tap into it, like who is done for you, and it allows for the heart to be transformed a bit. And then the other part to that is that you keep some journals. It doesn't have to be every day, but every few days. It's built into our prayer. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah, Allahu Akbar. Attach reasons to it. You're not just rotely putting things on your fingers. And I'm going to say it to you a bunch of times. You have to pray your prayers, but you have to think about why you're not, what's getting in the way in your hearts, and what are you giving an abode in your heart. But you can't yield what is promised through the completion of an act without doing the act. Do you know what I mean? So using this in this way. There's a couple of other things that we want to think about in terms of intention, but I'll start with that next time. I wanted to read you one last thing. This is like something my wife shared with me from a sheikha, who she was close to, a female scholar, that was on fasting. And as we're starting our journey with fasts and intentions, which is like a physical act, right? You're not eating or drinking. If you smoke, no smoking. You shouldn't smoke. Smoking is bad for you, right? No physical intimacy with your spouse. But we deepen in our sense of what we're bringing to the fast. So the sheikha, she says, there are as many forms of fasting as there are organs of perception and sensation. And each of these has many different levels. So we ask to fast from all that Allah does not love for us, and to feast on what the Beloved loves for us. Let us certainly fast from the limited mind and all that it conjures up. Let us fast from fear, apart from fear and awe of Allah's majesty. Let us fast from thinking that we know, when Allah alone is the knower. Let us fast from thinking negatively of anyone. Let us fast from our manipulations and strategies. Let us fast from all complaint about the life experiences that Allah gives us. Let us fast from our bad habits and our reactions. Let us fast from desiring what we do not have. Let us fast from obsession. Let us fast from despair. Let us fast from not loving ourselves and from denying our heart. Let us fast from selfishness and self-centered behavior. Let us fast from thinking that only what serves us is important. Let us fast from seeing reality only from our own point of view. Let us fast from seeing any reality other than Allah and from relying on anything other than Allah. Let us fast from desiring anything other than Allah and Allah's prophets and friends and our own true self. Essentially, let us fast from thinking that we have any existence separate from Allah. That's how I want to fast this Ramadan. What's going to get in the way from making that happen? The obstacles inward and out. What am I carrying in my heart? That when I'm in Ramadan, I'm going to now see it potentially as a burden and a distraction, rather than a source of liberation. How can I fast when I have my meeting? You can, man. Just fast when you have your meeting. That's all you got to do. How can I fast when I have a test or an exam? You can. You just fast when you have the test or the exam. The idea is that it creates enhancement and focus. Take it from somebody who fasts regularly throughout the year. The days that I fast, my attentiveness is more razor sharp than the days that I don't fast. Because I'm not in a place where my stomach is defining decisions. I'm in a place where I'm nurturing other parts of me that get lost when my stomach is sovereign over my body. If you're worried about it, start fasting now. My kids, I'm going to have them fast a couple of days to practice on the weekends, because I know they're going to both come to me and say, I want to try to fast, Baba. And I'm not going to make excuses for them. They want to do something, I'm going to try to help them do it. That's my job as a parent. My job isn't to like make their decisions. My job is to make them see the consequences of their decisions, right? Last Ramadan, my kids hung out with a lot of you all in Ramadan. And I don't know who sat with them, but someone told them, in Ramadan, one of the best things ever is you go to a diner and you have suhoor before Fajr. And my kids throughout Ramadan, Baba, we got to go to a diner and we got to have pancakes and waffles for before Fajr time. I was like, all right, if you want to. We went to a diner near our house like an hour before Fajr started. My kids were miserable. They had their face in the tables. The food came. They're like, I don't want to eat this. Right? And I was like, well, how do you like suhoor at the diner? And they're like, this isn't fun, Baba. Like, why did everyone tell us to do this? I was like, I don't know. But are we going to do this again? Are we just going to stay at home? Like, we just want to be at home, you know? And they're little kids. So if you ever have a little kid, it's cute. But it's also just for them miserable. But for you as the adults, cute. They're like sleep crying. My son's like, I don't know. He's shoving pancakes in his mouth at the same time, right? Yeah, but you know, you experience something. My son is 8 years old. You are not 8 years old. Why would you wait till the first day? Why? What are you thinking? If you take it seriously and you want to yield something from it, equip yourself to know where you stand in relation to it now. And it's not the same every year. It shouldn't be, because you should have fluctuation. When I interview people for stuff, or people want to work at businesses we own, or nonprofits, or here, or whatever, and they show me resumes, and like, I got 10 years experience in this, and 20 years of that. It's like, no, man, you just lived the same year 20 times in a row. That's not the same. It should not be that every year it's the same experience. This is the danger with ritual. It becomes overtly ritualized as the goal. It is not difficult to not eat, especially as the days are getting shorter. Do you know? And you have the blessing. You might see it as what's not there, that, oh, daylight savings time is going to push the time we break our fast an hour. It's going to also push back the time you start your fast an hour. Right? You want to see what's there. The example that I like to use is why the gratitude things come in. I took my kids to the park and they want ice cream. It's an ice cream truck and it's a large line at the truck. Both of them come with me to the truck. One of them says, I don't want to wait in the line. The other's like, I'm going to wait in the line. We wait in the line. The kid gets ice cream. We go back now where the other kid is. I wish I had ice cream too. One of them saw the ice cream. The other saw the line. What do you see when you are determining how you are readying yourself for this? What do you see? It's a product of what's going on in here. Do you get what I mean? I'm not a terrible dad. Like, don't get me wrong, right? But they have to be equipped to understand what this religion is about. Is not just about, let me teach you the letters of the Quran and the forms of the prayer. They got to be able to tap in to what makes them inherently human, right? This is why if you were in the class before this, the 40 hadith class, last week we looked at the hadith where the narrator of the hadith, Nu'man ibn Bashir, he's born in Medina. So he's a child when this verse, this hadith he's listening to is being narrated. And it's a hadith about the heart. So as a kid, he's learning about the heart and its role in his just kind of movement forward. Do you get what I mean? So between this week and next week, just sit down. Who is somebody that I can write this thank you letter to? Who's somebody I can go and express gratitude? And you start actually doing it. It's going to start to make inside here feel a little bit different. How do I show appreciation? To Allah, to Allah's messenger, to my family, my friends, my community, my people, right? And simple things. It doesn't have to be like super, you know, kind of fancy all the time, right? And then the people I can get away with not saying thank you to, how do I start expressing gratitude towards them? And if you want to have a one-on-one that says, I don't know how to deal with this stuff, that there's no way. Your heart has to be precious enough that you don't learn how to take care of it by watching a recorded lecture on YouTube of an audience that you weren't even seated in, where someone's talking to 1,000 people that you weren't even one of them. You got to have people who care about you enough, and then you have to also care about yourself enough to cut out excuses. The number of people who say to me when I sit with them, I know you're so busy, that's why I like hesitate in reaching out to you. I'm like, man, I'm sitting here talking to you right now. Do not use me as an excuse as to why you don't get done what you need to get done. I don't say that to them because they're usually not in a good place when they're talking to me. But I'm saying it to you all right now, right? I will make the time, not because it's a burden, but because I care about you. I know what it's like to carry heaviness inside of me. I know what it's like to have no one to talk to when you're trying to figure it out. So our hadith teaches us that you love for your brother what you love for yourself. I like being in a place where I don't have to carry that kind of stuff inside of me anymore. I want you to have that too. So to dig deeper into it in the prism of intention, it doesn't have to be with me. I can help you find somebody else that you could talk to also if you need it. But as you write these thank you letters and this gratitude journal, we want to also start to think out what else is going on in there. What else am I carrying? Whether it's for days or it's been for years. And how do I start to navigate some of that? Do you get what I mean? And sometimes all it is about just letting it out in a space that you can just say whatever you want to, you know? And then you don't have to hold it all alone. It's not like very solution oriented. It's just validating the feelings. So then you're not scared to acknowledge that they're there. And then what we do is we detangle them, so that they don't exist in a lump altogether, because feelings feel very similar. So if something made you sad and something made you grieving, like the two of them can just bleed, and we want to separate them so that you can confront them as individual obstacles, not one giant obstacle. Do you see what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Okay, what I'd like for you to do is take 2 minutes, turn to the persons next to you. What are you taking away from this conversation today? What's some of the things that are coming up? We'll come back and discuss, and then we'll wrap up for today. But go ahead. Yeah, I'll tell them when we're wrapping.
Like,
Okay, so what are some of the things we're taking away from today? Just as we wrap up. Anything that's coming up for people?
Intention does not, it's like, when you have intention, you stay away from making random choices. Because with intention, you have to be present. And instead of like checking yourself. Because you have this intention of, you know, doing this or have a goal to hold your intention. And I would say this, you know, don't do random things. Because when you do random things, you don't get anywhere. You don't achieve much. And it's not about achieving like material things, but it's more about achieving things that will give you peace. You know, so that's what we're talking about. And how we are also entitled when we, in this society, we're entitled when we start seeing. You gave that example of, I saw this lady picking up the can. Here we are thinking that we are better because we made it. It's just nonsense. And that entitlement has us so divided because now we're starting classifying people based on our own beliefs. Therefore, we are better. But we lose community when we do that. Because at the end of the day, we're all human. And we have to go through pains and joys and, you know, so it's just.
Yeah, amazing. Other thoughts? Anything? Yeah.
I feel like definitely especially this whole conversation that just, you know, gain more knowledge, where it's like cleaning your heart is actually way more important than I originally thought it was, right? Because, like, you know, usually we say during Ramadan, we say, oh, you know, I'm going to fix all my mental issues or all my baggage or whatever, and we say it lightly. These are actually way bigger and way more important than it is, because it affects everything that you do, right? Whether it be how the way you think, or the way you act, the mannerisms, how you view yourself, confidence, and so on and so forth. So that's why I feel like definitely, like, you know, this was a good thing where it's like I kind of learned a little bit more, like, you know, how I should prioritize certain things.
Amazing. Great. Anyone else before we wrap up? What do you take away from today? Yeah.
Well, like Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he had Jibreel to give him like that open heart surgery and clean his heart. But we, as like lay people, we don't have that. So, like Hara said, you have to clean out your heart and you have to do it often. And I feel like it's something that people don't do. So.
Yeah, this is where you bring intention, right? The recitation of the Quran, it's like a mechanism for this. Acts of kindness and charity, it's a mechanism. Like, think about this, right? Think like about the world you live in. Do you know people who volunteer a lot? Like who go visit the sick in the hospitals and do these kind of stuff? Do they tend to be like jerks? No, right? Like those are pretty much the nicest people. The ones who you're like, what did you do this weekend? I, you know, went to visit people in the hospital who weren't feeling so well. Are they related to you? No. Like, do you know them? No. They're just doing that. But the doing of it is indicative of what's in their heart. But also when they do it, it's doing something for their heart. Do you get what I mean? Right? So these are all things you can do. This is what Ramadan is. Increased charity, recitation of the Quran, like remembrance of God, prayer, fasting. Like you bring the intention to do the act for what it's intended to achieve, which is not as an ends, but a means to something. So it's transformative of your inner self. And it's calling you to something that's not a sociological identity variable, but it's like a set of convictions and belief, right? So you have to determine, do I really like believe in this thing to the extent that I am going to get up before Fajr because I believe that the meal before Fajr has barakah in it. It's got blessing. And then the blessing allows for me to be able to carry forward in the rest of my day. Do you know? Next week, we're going to kind of build off of this a little bit more, talk about habit formation, why we do some of the things that we do, you know, from a different standpoint, get into like consciousness, taqwa, which is an Arabic word that gets associated often with like the practice of fasting in the Quran. It's associated with the reading of the Quran itself. Sorry, the practice of fasting, the recitation of Quran, other things. So we build a relationship with the concept, right? Because you can look through all kinds of books and there's so many people, you know, Umar ibn al-Khattab, who's the second caliph of Islam and a companion of the Prophet, he has a definition of what taqwa is. He talks about it as if one is walking through like a kind of area that has, growth with thorns, right? And you're walking delicately so your clothes don't get caught on the thorns, right? There's mindfulness of the situation around you. But Sufyan al-Thawri, who comes a generation later, he also has a definition of what taqwa is. Hasan al-Basri also has a definition, like others have definitions. None of them are saying, this is what the person said, so that's what it is. But they're building a unique relationship with the concept. They can identify and define for themselves, this word has meaning to me in this way. Do you get what I mean? So the value isn't in memorization, or just to quote, the value is in building relationship with the concept and to be able to understand how it informs and how do I elevate it and escalate it. Do you know what I mean? Who cares if you can quote like the articles of faith in Islam and just repeat it when you don't know like where iman exists within you, faith, and what does faith look like? Do you know what I mean? Like, what's the point of taqwa? What is it meant to be doing for me? And why is it something that is much needed in the world right now? So we're going to talk about that on Monday the 19th, which is President's Day, which is like a few weeks from now. This building is closed. I don't know what we're going to do that day. There's a good chance we're just not going to meet that day. But also we might meet in my apartment building, where some of you have been. Like in the summers, we do my Monday night halakas there. We'll like dinners at our place often, right? Some of you have been over. We'll have to have all of you over, you know, for different stuff. But I'll keep people updated and let you know by next week what's going to happen there. But just keep that in the back of your mind. And then there might be an option that we just do it on Zoom if we're not able to do it in person because of space constraints. Okay, great. So let's take a pause here. So we'll see everybody next Monday, inshallah. And we'll pick up from there. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I didn't know you were going to speak.